Hello, and welcome to our podcast for the Comprehensive Opioid, Stimulant, and Substance Abuse Program, known as COSAP, which is an initiative of the Bureau of Justice Assistance. I'm your host, Paige Pressler-Jurr, with the RTI COSAP Training and Technical Assistance Team. We are here to celebrate National Recovery Month. This is our final episode in our series that has been highlighting individuals across the criminal legal system to focus on what National Recovery Month means to their work and how they strive to support people in recovery. These conversations join together voices of individuals and community members across the nation who make recovery in all its forms possible. Here to help us with this discussion is Joanne McLaurin Carpenter, the Assistant Director of Chesterfield Colonial Heights Pretrial and Community Correction Services, a human services agency working to provide effective community supervision, treatment options, victim services, and alternatives to incarceration. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you, Paige. I'm glad to be with you today.
I would love to hear about your story. How did you get to your role supporting individuals as they re-enter their communities?
Well, I have always had an interest in human services. Specifically, I enjoy the opportunity to show people that they can change. I have always been interested in providing people with opportunities for education, for learning, and specifically to recover, because I think those individuals have the most difficult time because there are so many barriers and so many things that have happened to them that have caused them to lose family and lose security or job or support or whatever it is that they have lost. And so I've always had an interest in human services and allowing people the opportunity to change and to assist them on that journey in any way I can. And so that being said, I had an opportunity to become a pretrial probation officer for a program called the Dual Treatment Track in Chesterfield County. Specifically, that program assists clients who have serious mental illness, substance use disorder, and obviously involvement with the court. And so to be able to help people who have a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder get to a point where they are employed or back in contact with their children or just have a mindset to not want to use or to want to have a sponsor, that was a great interest to me. And I love seeing, I know this is kind of a corny term, but the light bulb go off. I love seeing the clarity come. I love seeing them have goals and decide, you know what, this road that I was on wasn't great. And now I have an opportunity to take advantage of these mental health services, take advantage of treatment, whatever is necessary. So that was one of the best jobs I have to say I've ever had. And I stayed as a pretrial probation officer for 12 years in the dual treatment track, assisting clients work through the court order, but also work through recovery. So that's where I started.
Can you tell us more about the important role a probation officer can play in a person's recovery journey?
Absolutely. So when I started with community corrections, which is where I worked as a pretrial and probation officer, there are several opportunities that individuals have when they are referred to us by the court. And so as a pretrial or probation officer, you know, I think people only think of us as people who do drug testing. But that's just a little piece of who we are. We are officers of the court. We are sworn officers. And so we help obviously decipher the court order and we help explain to them how can they complete whatever the court order says so that they can no longer be on pretrial or no longer be on probation. But that is just a little bit of the work that community corrections does in the community and that pretrial and probation officers do in the community. Because when we have an individual before us, we have an opportunity to ask, how did you get here? What happened? Because in order for them to be successful at whatever the court has asked them to do, we have to find out how they ended up before us in the first place. So it's not going to be helpful if we talk about, hey, you have 24 hours community service to do, and you have to do drug testing, and you have to do A through Z, and they're hurting, or they need mental health treatment. So today's probation officer has to be skilled in motivational interviewing, has to be skilled. I know people were always saying meet the people where they are, but actually listen and find out what we're dealing with and what barriers they have today that might prevent them from being successful in completing what the court order is. So we are an in-between. We're the go-between, but we have the benefit that the judges don't have. The judges have a few minutes with the client, right? But we have them sitting in front of us. And so it gives us an opportunity to have a conversation, to talk about what needs they have, and to find out how we can help them not only complete what the court is asking, but then to be successful when they leave us. So it is an important role in the community, hence community corrections.
Great. And would you share for us some stories that really highlight that impact that you're having?
I was thinking about a past client. What is interesting to me is that when he came to me, probably in his 30s, he had been in the criminal justice system most of his life. And what was interesting to me is that it was his parent who taught him to steal at first at like 5 or 6 years old. And it was his parent that eventually introduced him to substance use. And so by the time I got him, you know, he was 30 something and just didn't want to be on probation anymore. That was his goal. Wasn't really caring about all the other issues that he was having in his life, but I just don't want to be involved in probation anymore. To me, that was an easy goal because I knew that if I kept that goal before him, if you do these things, you don't have to come see us anymore. But eventually, you know, he had some difficulty because we all know substance use is difficult. And though he worked and eventually got married and had a child, that substance use was always an issue for him. And it kept returning him back to the criminal justice system. But, you know, when we worked on him realizing in order not to be on probation, there's some other things I need to heal. There's other things I need to deal with. And so when he allowed us to talk about mental health, when we talked about going in the community and going to meetings and thinking about not using, starting there, even though he was in pre-contemplation when we received him, but moving him to action. Then he began to see, you know what, this is possible. This is my goal of not being on probation, but there's all these other goals that I can accomplish on my way there. So he stands out in my mind because to start on that road at such a young age, and then to be, you know, 30 something and still having to deal with the criminal justice system, I can't even imagine. But to see the light go on and him realize, you know, and he eventually moved because he realized he couldn't stay here and make the change that he wanted to make. And so, you know, for us as officers, we oftentimes don't see all the great success stories. And a lot of times people are not saying thank you. But for us to have someone go to court and either get their charge, you know, lessened to a misdemeanor or just be able to not have to be on pretrial or probation is a success. And so those are the kind of things that we as officers realize it may not be a lot to other individuals, but for us, if someone is no longer on probation, that's a success.
You have been working in the field of community corrections for 18 years. Can you tell our listeners about the shifts that you've seen and what recovery means to people?
We are far from where we used to be, and I'm actually really glad about that. You know, when I started, we were very much test positive, inform the court, ask for a capias, ask for a show cause, return back to court. Courts would keep them incarcerated for a period of time, return them back to the community, and we would do it all over again. And so there wasn't really a lot of how else can we solve this puzzle? What else could we be using? And over the years, I have seen that change. Even us as a community corrections agency, we have pretrial and probation, and we have specialized units that deal with JDR, domestic violence cases, and general district and circuit court cases, but we also have 3 treatment programs. And so to have a drug court, and we have a program called the Center of Risk Reduction that deals with lowering risk, and to have a dual treatment track, which deals with mental health and substance use disorder, is a change from where we were years ago. We have relationships with Chesterfield Mental Health. We have relationships with the jail. We have relationships with MAT providers in the community. Where we were, where we were kind of siloed. So all of the agencies, we've had the same individual coming in and out of our door. But now there's relationship with every intercept in the criminal justice system. And so we are no longer just about if someone is positive and we just advise the court. The court has given us a little bit of leeway to find out, is there a treatment modality they need? Is there some counseling? What else can we do other than just incarcerating? Now, sometimes that is necessary, but sometimes that's not the answer to the puzzle. And so we now have a lot more resources at our disposal that we can offer to the clients in hopes of helping them in recovery.
And how do you feel that this has impacted the field of community corrections as a whole?
I think we are more successful. I think what has happened is the training and the mindset of pretrial and probation officers has changed. And so we are educating ourselves differently. We are learning the techniques that we need to have. We are talking about motivational interviewing and emotional intelligence and talking about success planning and all of the things that we need to do that to assist the individual on their road to success. So I think what it does, it provides the court with greater resources because we are in the community. And obviously, it's less people incarcerated. Hopefully more people are recovering. Our communities are safer. And so I think it has changed just our outlook and our level of engagement in seeing what the individual needs. We are a more engaged workforce, and we don't just have this one option to us. There's a lot more options for us to use now.
When we spoke initially, you actually told me how important it was within Chesterfield County that you and your team actually explain and educate the need around medication-assisted treatment. Can you tell our listeners about how you all did that and what an impact it made?
Our area, Chesterfield County, received a Building Bridges grant. And thankfully, already at the table were many of the criminal justice partners. So the jail and just for mental health and us and social services and emergency services, EMTs, the CA's office were already having talks in relationship with each other about clients and how to improve services. And so this Building Bridges grant that we received allowed us to hire specifically a pretrial officer who only has MAT cases. And so she is aware of who's providing MAT in the community. She's aware when the client comes in and they may be having some difficulties or some side effects, being able to have a conversation with them about what's happening with that. And just being able to introduce people who may think that that's an option to them of what services are available in the community. And so I have to tell you, 2 years ago, we probably would have not had MAT. And all of our treatment programs actually allow people now who come into the program to use MAT. That to me was unheard of a few years ago because there's a stigma around recovery. To be using a substance does not really mean that you're in recovery. I'm glad we've realized there's many roads to recovery. There's not just one way to get there. And so it has allowed the jail to provide it. So if they have someone who's coming into a resident of the jail now, they are able to continue an MAT. Because we have a relationship with the jail, if someone is coming out and they're being released to one of our programs, we are already setting up an appointment with them, with Chesterfield Mental Health, to get that service immediately when they're released. And that way we don't have a break in service. You know, there still probably is a lot of stigma around it. But I say for individuals who are able to use it, you know, it may not be forever. It may be a temporary thing that they have to do. But if it is keeping them alive, and it's an option for them, then we're going to support them in that choice.
It sounds like close partnerships were invaluable to this that you achieved and to reducing that stigma. Can you tell us more about that?
I think our officers are grateful to be able to call our local mental health providers, to be able to have relationship with recovery homes, to have relationship with our treatment providers, with the jail, even with the CAs and the police. This process of us changing how we think about recovery could not have happened if from the start, starting with the police all the way through community corrections and recovery homes and treatment providers are not believing in the same opportunities that are available to the client. So if you start with the police and you have police who have been trained in crisis intervention, and you at the end in community corrections and they end up with a pretrial probation officer who understands that they may need MAT or what it is if they need mental health services and recovery homes who can help provide transportation or job training or whomever the stakeholder is, is a piece of the whole process. It changes what the individual is receiving. And so what comes to mind, which is fantastic, is our emergency services, EMTs, when they arrive at homes when there's been an overdose, they have peer recovery specialists that within 24 hours are making connection with those individuals if they're interested in help, just leaving a phone number and a card and following up. So for us, our community realizes at every point where we may come in contact with someone who is having a difficult time, that we are saying the same things and have the same mindset about how to help them, and also being aware of all the other services that are in the community.
And can you tell us where harm reduction might fit in to this piece and within your organization and community corrections?
Some would find it interesting that we as pretrial and probation officers would be talking harm reduction. But for us, what's interesting, we as community corrections are actually a Narcan distribution site. And we decided to do that because we realized in our community, overdoses are happening. They're more than ever before. Fentanyl is dangerous. And so for us not to respond to it didn't make sense. And so we decided that we would train staff, and we have an outreach coordinator who came and helped train staff and talk to staff. Because, you know, when you think about it, if someone's on pretrial and probation, they may be with us for drug testing and they are supposed to be abstinent. They're not supposed to be using any substances. And so why would you be handing out Narcan? But not everybody is doing well. And so sometimes family members come with, you know, the individuals. Sometimes, you know, husbands and wives come. And sometimes the individual themselves were shy at first at taking it. But how we present it is, it may not be for you. It may be for a family member. We're not asking about where you are in recovery. We're not asking if you're using. We're saying this could save a life. Are you willing to learn about it and share it with someone who you know who may need it? And so for us, being able to educate staff, to be able to talk about Narcan, to be able to talk about, you know, education and counseling and treatment, our agency hands out condoms. They're in a basket at our offices, at front desk. And we don't even have to have a conversation about that. That's self-explanatory. Having an MAT officer, having peer recovery specialists who come into our building, into treatment groups, and talk about meetings that are in the community. We have people who have never tried to recover, who are with us for the first time and have no idea what it means to have a sponsor or where it's safe to go to a meeting. Maybe they only want an all-women's meeting. And so having peer recovery specialists in our building is harm reduction. Having Narcan and treatment and pamphlets and education is harm reduction. Every time we have a conversation with someone, we're hoping to reduce the harm.
It sounds like many other communities can learn so much from the experiences of Chesterfield County. Can you tell us where harm reduction fits into your work and into the community corrections field?
You know, I think we have to come to it at all angles. For me, prevention, prevention, prevention. If we can prevent middle school age and high school age from even heading down that road, however it comes to them, through, you know, medications in their house, you know, through injuries, whatever it is, of course, our world would be a much better place because we know younger and younger. And unfortunately, sometimes through no fault of their own, they are exposed and something happens to them. They get hurt. And unfortunately, opiates and narcotics are given, and prevention. I can't really speak to that enough. And educating our teachers, educating schools, educating parents, you know, because as a parent, you obviously want your children to be safe and well and whole. And so it seems like they get hurt. Seems like it makes sense that we would offer this pain medication. It seems like a simple thing, but it could cause so much harm. And so for me, I really do believe it starts there. If, you know, something happens and we found an individual in teens and adults and, you know, however way they come into it, there has to be an understanding, some way of building intrinsic motivation in them. And how we get to that for each individual is going to be different. There's not one way to recover. And thinking of times that I've talked to parents and parents have said, well, why can't they just stop? It's hurting them. They keep going to jail. They've used my credit card. I don't want to press charges. There's so many things that happen in a family. And so communities need to be able to support families. You know, all of the Al-Anons and AA and all of those kinds of grassroots in churches, in schools, in your community, in recovery homes, where they're talking and helping and supporting the family of those with loved ones. So they have an understanding that if they could stop, they would. And until they find the right puzzle piece, until they find the right road of recovery, journey, path, whatever you want to call it, here's how you can help them. Here's how you can support them. And then, you know, for the individuals who are struggling, we need support services for when they return to the community. So when they have burned all the bridges, hence, you know, the Building Bridges Grant, when they've burned all the bridges, we still need recovery homes. We still need employers who will hire them. We still need places in the community where they can get services. We did a strategic planning event, my department. And one of the things we would love to have, like, this huge one-stop building where you have all of the players present who can provide all of those services. I'm talking like DMV and Social Security and Medicaid and employers and housing and recovery and MAT and health and dental and representative from the court and your pretrial officer, you know, available. Because it's difficult if you have burned all your bridges and you've stolen from your parents and you've tried this and you come out and you have no place to live. I can't even imagine doing that. It really does take the neighborhood, the tribe, whatever you want to use, it does take a community to help. So I think moving forward, we need to prevent, educate, support, counsel, treat, and cover all the bases from A to Z.
Wow, what you're describing sounds phenomenal. How do we get there?
That's a good question. Money, grants, you know, stigma is real. I'm not going to act like it's not. I mean, we're not all rainbows and roses. It is a difficult and challenging and often sad work that we do in the community. And so oftentimes, you know, a community may have a grant that they're using, but it's very specific toward what you can provide, which is necessary and wonderful, but you may not be able to pay rent with it. You may not be able to use a space for it, to have the one stop that we would like to have. And so sometimes I think being able to have access to monies to really address the true problem of the individual who is struggling in recovery. And sometimes that is money for a recovery house, paying first and security deposits. You know, if you're in the community and there's no transportation, how can you expect them to get to where they want to go if you can't help pay for transportation? Many have so many court costs and fines. Usually grant money cannot be used to help assist in any of that. And so when you begin to look at how do you help an individual recover if they have no place to live? They can live in a recovery house. They have to have a job, but they have to have money to get clothes and transportation to get a job. And so when you begin to look at those building blocks, you know, we who have a car, we who are employed and have a nice home and supportive family and people who we could call and ask for help don't realize what it means to not have a support system. And so I think about the grant allowed us to do great things, which was to hire staff and to provide a service that we had not provided before. Is it the end all be all to what we need? Absolutely not. Do we still need community leaders and government leaders to understand what recovery is and why we need MAT and why we should be training everybody in CIT and why it would be helpful to have peer recovery specialists and why do you need counselors available to the police to help when you have someone who's having a mental health crisis? There's lots of stigma and lots of educating that needs to happen. And so that is also something that we would need to do to be able to truly fulfill this opportunity we have to help people.
The theme of this COSAP podcast series has been what National Recovery Month means to people working across the criminal legal system, supporting justice-involved individuals and those on their recovery journeys. So Joanne, we would love to know what National Recovery Month means for your work and community supervision.
I think it's an opportunity for us to tell our stories, because when we tell the story of what we see and hear every day, the possibilities that people do recover, that it may seem like the news is telling us about fentanyl and overdoses and all of the negative things that is happening. But in community corrections, in grassroots organizations, in recovery homes, in jails that have treatment available, there is work being done to help people recover. I think it's an opportunity, and also for us as an agency to say thank you to our staff. You are doing a good job. It may seem like it's a little pebble in a big old ocean, but what you do every day does matter. And sometimes you don't get to see the end result. You may not always hear what happened, the positive effect that you have on the client. But we, as leaders in the community, understand that you come to work every day, and every day you sit down with a client and you help them in whatever way that is given into us in our realm of community corrections to a better place, whatever that is for them. And so for us, it's highlighting staff, time for us to toot our own horns. Hey, this is what we're doing. This is who we are. It's a time for us to recognize our fellow stakeholders and partners. It's a time for us to just as a whole to tell all who are here. It is a difficult journey, but there is hope, and people do recover, and people do change, and people do become well.
We are nearing the end of our time together. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would like to share that community corrections, local probation, and pretrial officers are in your community, and they are working to help people recover. And we are interested in our work. We are cheerleaders for the individuals who are doing well. We are a listening ear. We are promoters of wellness. We are not just officers of the court. We are not just about advising the court of what is not going well, but we will also tell the client and family members in the court when someone is making progress and someone is making change. And we are in the community trying to use whatever resources that we have to help people recover. And we're doing a good job.
I'd like to thank our guest today for chatting with me to discuss how community corrections can make significant impact on the lives of those in recovery and how it works to support each individual in a personalized way as they re-enter their community. Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you, Paige.
I'm Paige Pressler-Jurr, and I invite all of our listeners to check out www.cosapresources.org for additional resources and guidance for your community's overall strategy to support individuals in recovery and those that want to address their substance use.